Morning, church.
Good morning.
Oh, that was nice. I'm smiling. Why? Because I'm happy to be here. Are you?
Yes,
of course. Most of us think that the person up here on stage is the one who performs. And the audience is the spectators. We're going to listen to this guy, whoever he is, talking or telling the story or singing. And we've divided ourselves into the performer and the spectator. Actually, false. There's only one group of performers, only one spectator. We are all the performers. We are performing for God. He is the focus. And so, what should I do? I should do my best to speak it the best. I should do my best to speak it clearly. And what would you do the best? Listen. Listen actively. Don't let your mind go out the window and out the door to that business stuff and to that ball game or to that appointment, not even to lunch. Stay right here, then you and I can perform for him. Let's do it all together. And then our hearts are all one. So be awake, don't go to sleep. That's the main message of this big introduction. Don't go to sleep. Well, I'm a teacher, but actually I'm a physician. A medical doctor, born and brought up in India, and then came to the United States. Went on a search, because India, most of the religions in India are not Christian. Christians constitute about 2% of the population. So naturally, growing up there, you had many questions. I had many questions, and I went on a search which lasted 20 years. At the end of 20 years, I had a whole bunch of information in my hands, and then I spent the next 5 years trying to organize that information so it would make sense to me. The questions I asked were my questions, not somebody else, and I wanted to know the answers for myself. At the end of 25 years then, I had a kind of organized stuff which seemed to make a lot of sense to me. And then when I started presenting it to a bunch of university students, they said, boy, it makes good sense. And that started out my ministry. It's called Search Seminars International. I've been doing it for 8 years. Been to 5 continents just by invitation. Word of mouth, invitation. And my main focus is secular university lecture halls. That's where I speak. That is my ministry. And there's hardly anyone who goes there. Because there is where you meet the intelligentsia, the academia, who laugh and scorn at the idea of God. So to go there knowing they're going to laugh at you, jeer at you, would be a daunting task. But if after 20 years you have found something to make good sense, then it's not daunting at all. You can bring it there to the people. That's what I'm going to do this morning. I'm going to speak to you like I speak in the secular lecture halls. I'm not going to discuss or study the Bible. I'm going to discuss and study about the Bible. That's what I do out there. And so that is what I will present to you this morning. But as with every other topic of endeavor, when you are dealing with things that are not mundane, when you are dealing with things that are extraordinary, we need help. So, let's bow our heads in prayer. Heavenly Father, God, mighty, powerful. And when I've looked at it, God, you are the only real authority in this universe. And being high and lifted up and powerful, what assurance it is to my heart that I find you tender, considerate, and loving. That's beautiful, God. And I ask that in your mercy, you will send forth your Spirit. We want him here. We want that he direct our thoughts and our minds and our words so that we can understand. And once we have understood, may our minds be fixed on the one about whom this book is written, Jesus. And it is in his name we pray. Amen. I'm going to sit down while I speak just because of my back. That clock over there is small. So I'm going to pretend I can't see it. How many minutes? When do you usually?
You just keep going until you're done.
Oh, he said you can keep going until you're done. My seminar is 8 hours long. We've finished about half hour, so there's just about 7.5 hours left. So forget your lunch and everything. India has the largest Hindu population in the world. More than 800 million in one country. But few people know that India has the second largest Muslim population in the world. We have more Muslims in India than in the Muslim countries themselves. Buddhism was born in India, in the northeastern part of India. In fact, as a physician, I used to work in a hospital not very far away from the Bodh Gaya tree, the tree under which Gautama Buddha was enlightened. It's a ficus tree. Christianity came to India in the first generation of Christianity, at least so the traditional writings say, because St. Thomas came down to the peninsula. And even today, when you go to the lower southern parts of the Indian peninsula, you do find monuments to St. Thomas. Sikhism, Jainism, the Persians came down from Persia through the Khyber Pass into the peninsula. And you have Zoroastrianism also in India. Boy, what a mixture in which to grow up. Naturally, I had a lot of questions. Like I said, I asked them. And when I finished putting them together, it's in the form of the seminar, 8 hours. But I'm going to show you only two parts of that. What I did was I asked people questions, and then I wrote down and kept mental notes. And as I began to ask, first I asked, how do I know which one to go? Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, which one? And then as I asked people to try to figure out what they're trying to say as their claims, here comes this other guy who says, heck, you talking about Buddhism and Hinduism? These people believe in God. There is no God. Oh, that's another question. So I had to answer that first, because if there is no God, what's the use of trying to find out which religion? Right? Yeah, so I had to ask that question. How do I know that there is something beyond the natural known as the supernatural? How would I know? So who is this I? This I is somebody who wants a good reason. Don't just tell me because I'm not going to swallow it. I need a good reason. And I could not go to the religions and ask for, is there a God in existence? Because the religion already believes there's a God in existence. That'd be circular reasoning. So the only way I could settle that is to go to a secular source. Any other source to find out whether there's a God in existence would be circular reasoning. All the religions already believe in God. So what's the use of going to them? It's like coming to me and saying, are you telling the truth? I say, yes, I'm telling the truth. How do you know? Because I'm telling it to you. That's circular reasoning. No, it wouldn't work. So I went first to that question and formulated my method of looking at it. Three criteria. It should be based on evidence, reason, logic. That's it. Science. And wonder of wonders. When you really apply this, the needle of evidence points clearly to one side. Beyond the natural, every true scientist must acknowledge there is the supernatural. So once we've settled that, okay, there's a supernatural. There may be a God. Yeah, probably there is. Maybe, yeah, there's a good chance there is a God. So now, how shall we identify him? And so when I tried to do that, I realized I can't identify him because there are so many claims out there that already say we've identified him. The Hindus, the Muslims, the Buddhists, all of them say we've got it. So I had to figure out how shall I weigh this out. Now to cut a long story short, you can't compare apples and oranges. You simply can't. So I had to go to what is known as the para-religious factors. In other words, factors that were not really religious, but with the religion really relied upon. Every religion came to the human race via a story. All tenets of belief, doctrinal matters from every religion came to us in the form of a story. So I directed my mind to the story. If the story was credible, then well, the teaching also might be credible. If the story was shaky, well, it's not that the teachings were wrong, but they just lost credibility. So I formulated 10 questions. 10 questions. I would ask these 10 to these 5 religions, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, Judaism, and Christianity. And what I would do was simply pull out the answers from the writings. I could not controvert whether they were right or wrong. I was not in a position to do that. I would just ask the question and get the writings, answers from the writings, and place it on the table and see what happens. The 10 questions were what forms my seminar. I'm going to present just 2. The first question is, what kind of literature is the writing? Ancient literature is classified into folklore, legend, myth, historical. What do I mean by those words? Folk tale, there is no attempt to state a real or true story. The main intent is to be interesting and bring out a lesson or a moral. In other words, a person who's telling you a folk tale knows the story is not really true. The sun didn't really smile. The wind did not really whisper in anybody's ear. And the birds did not meet as a full committee meeting. No. They know it's not right. But they state it because they want to make a lesson or a moral. How about a legend? It's probably based on a real true story, but changes begin generations after the event when eyewitnesses are no longer alive to challenge your change. And legends begin generations after the event. In fact, it usually takes centuries to form a legend. How do I know? Here's a statement about Gautama Buddha and a certain sculptor. This medallion dates back certainly to the 2nd century BC. If we put the Buddha's nirvana, his death, during the 5th century, now that's 300 years, then the artist who carved the medallion must have lived at a time when the memory of the Blessed One, which is Gautama Buddha, was still very fresh in the minds of the people. 300 years and the story is still very fresh in the minds of the people. In other words, in the words of a historian, a legend develops only centuries later. That's why we say centuries is required. Myth, it is so far back in history that it generally accepts as somebody's imagination. The story is probably not true. And the time period is many centuries and even millennia. How about the historical? The attempt is to state the story as it really was. There are no significant additions, no core changes. All ancient religious writings have changes. The question is whether it's a core change. In other words, did it change the direction of the story itself? The closer to the event, the greater the credibility. Now, that's very important. In fact, there are three gaps that historians look at to attest to the credibility of any writing. Number one is the event to the oral tradition, this gap. Every event, after it took place, the community made a story out of it. And they passed it on from generation to generation by word of mouth. That's called the oral tradition. That's one gap. When did it happen? When was the oral tradition established? Then between the oral tradition and the written tradition, the first manuscript that was written, when did it translate from oral to writing? That gap. And the third gap is between the first manuscript and the earliest manuscript we have in our hands. So if the point is, if these gaps are very close, the credibility rises. If the gaps are really broad and wide, then the credibility goes down. We're not saying it's wrong, we're just saying the credibility goes down. So with this, let's look at the writings. Hinduism, the earliest manuscript is, the earliest writing is the Rig Veda, followed by the Upanishads, then an epic, which is the big story called the Ramayana, and then the epic, which is called the Mahabharata. Epic is a big story, long story, in which is found the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is kind of understood as the kernel of Hindu thought, although not strictly, but it still is. If you quote from the Bhagavad Gita, then you are talking Hinduism. That's what the meaning of that is. So what do we find in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita? Lord Krishna first spoke Bhagavad Gita to the sun god some hundreds of millions of years ago. That's difficult for anybody to check, right? I couldn't check it out. Nor can any honest scholar check it out. Nor can the Hindu scholars check that out. So everybody agrees that Hindu writings are basically, in their stories, mythological in character. For example, this statement from the Encyclopedia of Mythology: Krishna, according to the Hindu mythology, is an avatar, an incarnate of Vishnu, the preserver of the universe. So, Hindu literature, mythological. When it comes to Buddhist, I've got four statements here in chronological order. The first one: was he not born in Lumbini? Did he not complete existence at Kusinara? In other words, didn't Gautama Buddha, wasn't he born here? And didn't he die here just like anybody else? That's by a Theravada monk who was a contemporary of Gautama Buddha. Look at the second sentence. Soon after the passing of the master, Gautama Buddha, a change began to set in. Ah, change. Number three sentence: at the beginning of the Christian era, that is 500 years have gone by now, the transcendental nature of the Buddha became more and more pronounced. When it comes to the Mahayana literature, which is 700 to 1000 years later, there is not much of the man left in the Buddha. He is now an exalted being who has lived for countless ages in the past and will continue to live forever. Did you see that? The contemporary of Gautama Buddha said he was born here and he died here. 700 years later, oh no, he was not born here. He lived so much earlier and he never will die. He'll live forever. He has changed And any change from an ordinary story, which really was a story to begin with, is called a legend. So people talk about the legend of Gautama Buddha, or Sakya Muni, which is another endearing term for Gautama Buddha. Judaism, lots of books, lots of authors. Honestly, I could not classify it into one. So I left it unclassified. Don't get angry with me. That's my honest thing. I couldn't classify it. If any of you can classify that those 39 books into one category, you can help me out. And it's still open. I could not classify it. Islam, the Quran was put together in writing by 652 CE, Common Era, within 30 years of Muhammad's life. And only some changes in the text are accepted by scholars. Actually, I'm being very, very liberal here. The truth is that one of the leaders, the third caliph, was told that there were too many variant readings of the Quran. So he got together a group of scholars, I mean top-notch scholars, and said, what is the real traditional writing? Not these variant readings. So they went through the length and breadth of the country, and they got together what they established as the correct traditional sayings of Muhammad, and put them together as the Quran that we have today. That's what we have today. But this leader, Uthman was his name, Caliph, he was so enthusiastic that he said, this should be retained and its purity. So what he did, he destroyed every other manuscript. So today, nobody can go and check to see whether what is there in the Quran today is really what was there in the manuscripts. Everything is destroyed. Only the Quran remains. If you trust Muhammad, well, the Quran is okay. But a person from the outside of the faith, when he looks and said, how can I check it out? You can't. Christianity, the earliest manuscript is 134 AD approximately. It's in UK in the John Ryland's Library, Manchester, United Kingdom. The original manuscripts were within 20 to 50 years of the life of Jesus. Do you know what the first writing of the New Testament is? We think of it as the Gospels, but no, they were the epistles of Paul. They antedate the Gospels. In fact, Galatians is the first writing of the New Testament. And remember, Paul came into the movement later than the disciples. Therefore, the story was already set. In other words, the oral tradition was already set. In fact, the earliest actual writing, it's not in the Bible. The earliest Christian writing was found by a Jewish archaeologist, Eliezer Sukenik. He was doing his archaeology when he came across two tombs. And the coins beside the tombs were dated to before AD 41. And on the tombs were inscriptions, Jesus is God. The second tomb, Jesus ascended one. These are the earliest writings of Christianity. And in the earliest writings, in which there was absolutely no chance to change him from a human to a god, he's called God. There's no time for any legend or mythological writing to develop. This has the shortest gap. It is confined to one generation and no core changes. Yeah, there are changes, but none core. We can already say emphatically that there is no longer any solid basis for dating any book of the New Testament except probably Revelation to about AD 80. Sir William Albright, Nelson Gluck, and Sir William Ramsay are the three greatest archaeologists we had of the previous generation. Between them, they were an authority. Look at what one of them said. We can say emphatically, you can't make it any greater than or later than AD 80, which is the same generation. How about Nelson Gluck? He's a Jewish archaeologist. It may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference. So William Ramsay is the next one I'm going to quote. He was from the UK, a brilliant archaeologist, and he set aside most of the New Testament because he thought they were inferior. And he went to do his archaeology in the times of Jesus. That was his archaeological study. And he specifically set aside Luke because Luke said he had done his study. If you look at the early part of the introduction to the book of Luke, he said, I've looked at it carefully and therefore I'm writing it. He put it aside because he thought Luke was not telling the truth. As he went into his digs, he would get stuck sometimes in trying to figure out, what am I looking at here? Which is archaeological finds. And he would read this manuscript, he would read that manuscript, he would go to that archaeologist and to the other, and finally he'd say, there's one over here called Luke. Let's look at that. And if he read that, he'd say, hey, that is explaining what I'm stuck with. And then he went on year after year, and every time he got stuck, he would look to Luke, and he would find Luke would unravel the mystery that he was finding right before him. And at the end of 30 years of his study, this is what he said. Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect of its trustworthiness. This author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians. Not religious historians. Very greatest of historians. Norman Geisler, one of the apologists of the Christian faith today, said, in all, Luke names 32 countries, 54 cities, and 9 islands without a single error. Amazingly historical. So, here I was an inquirer trying to weigh these books and try to see which one has a relevance and credibility. I was amazed at these statements. So what I did next was, compared the New Testament to what everybody acknowledges as historical literature, written about the same period of time. For example, Caesar's Gallic Wars. It was written in 100 BC, and the earliest manuscript we have is dated 900 AD, a gap of 1,000 years. In other words, in that gap, we don't know. Nobody can vouch whether anything was added, anything was deleted, anything was modified. Nobody can vouch for it. And yet we acknowledge that writing to be historical. How about Herodotus' history? 1,300 years. Cornelius Tacitus, 1,000 years. You can, go to the history departments of any of the universities today and quote these three and get your MAs and PhDs in history. Yes, because it's historical. Nobody says it's mythological. Nobody says it's legendary. Nobody says it's a figment of somebody's imagination. They say it is historical. But look at the gap. All right, compare that with the New Testament. Look at the gap. 20 years. And if you look at the coins, which I just mentioned from Eliezer Sukenik, 10 years. If you can swallow 1,000 years, why you gag and spit at 20 and 10? Isn't that fair? No, I'm just trying to be fair. If you honestly can swallow that much and say it is historical, then when it's 20 and 10, you should lift your hands and say, boy, we've got a historical piece of literature here. Right? Yes, it's historical. So the gaps, very short. In fact, of all the religious writing, the gap in the New Testament is the shortest. In true words, there is no gap at all. The event, the community story, the written tradition has no gap. The only writing that has no gap. The second point of credibility is the number of manuscripts. The number of manuscripts works like this. If there are only 5 or 6 manuscripts, one in that room and one in the other room there, then one night you could have gone to all of them, changed it, and nobody would know. You have corrupted the text. But if there are about 50, one here and one in Los Angeles and one in New York, then you'd have a hard time going to all of them in one night and changing all of them. In other words, the greater the number of manuscripts and more widespread it is, the more difficult it is to corrupt the text. Smaller the number, easier. Therefore, the smaller the number, the lower the credibility. The higher the number, the greater the credibility of the story, of the text. Look at the numbers. Caesar's Gallic was 10. Herodotus' history, 8. Tacitus' annals, 20. The champion of Greek literature is Homer's Iliad. Homer's Iliad is backed by 643 manuscripts. Now, that's a big number, right? Compared to 10 and 8 and 20. 643 manuscripts backs Homer's Iliad. And we are ready to say, wow, that's impressive, right? Yes, it's impressive. What if I tell you that the New Testament is based on 664 manuscripts? Then will you be willing to say, it's credible. Sounds credible, right? You all ready? Okay. The New Testament is backed by 5,664 Greek manuscripts. If you add the Armenian and the Arabic and the Latin and all the other manuscripts we have, do you know how many manuscripts back the New Testament? 24,900. Whoo! Look at that. Look at this number here. 10, 8, 20, and on this other side, 24,000. What is the comparison? So we're not talking about it being the word of God. We're just saying, is it credible literature? That's all we're saying. It is credible literature. 24,000. In other words, well, the third factor. One is the gaps. Number two is the number of manuscripts. Number three is, where was the author related to the story? Was the author separated in with geography? In other words, did he belong to another country or to another continent? Well, the further away, the less the credibility. Because he wouldn't know really the nuances of the culture in which the story took place, so he couldn't have written such detail. The other distance would be, maybe he lived in another generation, maybe another century. If they lived very far from the event, then the credibility of the story goes down. If they lived very close to the event, the credibility goes up. Look at these three statements we have on the screen. We, Peter, did not follow fables, but were eyewitnesses. John, from that hour, that disciple, which is John, took her, Mary, to his own home. How about Acts 27? Who wrote Acts? Luke, most likely. When we, Luke, had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia, we, Luke, came to Myra. This is the only writing in which the authors were not just close to the story, they were in the story. And you can't be closer than in. Are you with me? So you've got to be impressed. In real terms, the New Testament is easily the best attested ancient writing in terms of sheer number of documents and the time span between the events in the document and the variety of documents available to sustain or contradict it. There is nothing in ancient manuscript evidence to match such textual availability and integrity. No other ancient book has anything like such early and plentiful testimony to its text, and no unbiased scholar would deny that the text that has come down to us is substantially sound. In the variety and fullness of the evidence on which it rests, the text of the New Testament stands absolutely and unapproachably alone among ancient prose writings. Not ancient religious prose writings. Among all ancient writings. Among the Mayans, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, the Egyptians, the ancient Chinese, the Indians, the Romans, and the Greeks. You put them all together, that book that you have in your hands called the New Testament rises above every other ancient writing in the world as far as its attestation is concerned. In other words, if you are going to cast doubt on this writing called the New Testament as being historical, then to be skeptical of the resultant text of the New Testament is to allow all of classical antiquity to slip into obscurity, for no document of the ancient period are as well attested bibliographically as the New Testament. Wow. If you were searching for credibility, And if you found it like this, like I found, what would you say? Wow. Yeah, it makes good sense. It is historical. It is not mythological. You know, can you question historical writings? Of course you can question. But you can't deal with a historical piece of literature as you would deal with a mythological or legendary. Just wipe it off the table. No, you can't. If you want to question it, then you can question it, but question it on grounds of historical argument, not on grounds of it being legendary and mythological. So, the New Testament, the Quran and the New Testament are historical in nature, with the New Testament having the highest credibility of any ancient writing of that period. That was my first question. And boy, it did yield some results. So I went to the second question. Did the writing, at any time in the writing, allow me to check it out for authenticity? After all, the writing is about something from the supernatural world. I can't go to the supernatural world to see what the writing is true or not. I'm right here. So you got to tell me in your writing, is there a way I can test you? To check you for authenticity? That was my second question to the writings. And so, here's what I got. Hinduism, we have to accept it as it is. Otherwise, there's no point in trying to understand the Bhagavad Gita and its speaker, Lord Krishna. In other words, in the Hindu writings, the test is not in the writings. They say the test is in your experience of what is written there. But in the writings, there is no test. The same thing with Buddhism. Truth is unconditional, undeterminate, and beyond thought and word. In other words, you can't use your mind. You can't use reason, logic. You can't test it out. So Hindu literature and Buddhist literature do not allow you to test it. The test is in your experience. The fact is, every other religion also says that. So how superior are you when you say that it's in the experience? Every religion says that. The test is in the experience. I wanted to know why I want to experience it. That was my question. And I was just being honest. Like I said, I'm not trying to impress you. I was desperately looking for an answer for myself. Quran. The Islamic writing of Quran. There is a test. Here it is. Produce one chapter comparable to it. Call upon your idols to assist you if what you say is true. But if you fail, as you are sure to fail. There is a test. And when I read that, I said, wow, Hindus don't allow me to test and Buddhists don't allow me to test. Hey, the Quran is placing a test. So I better take it up now. Because I was being an honest inquirer, I took it up. And the moment I took up the test, four snags killed my attempt. Here are the four. It doesn't say what aspect to be equaled. It doesn't say you're supposed to equal it in either prose or poetry or rhythm or diction or philosophy or truth or God or tenets of belief or doctrine. So what shall I equal it in? Number two, it does not say how you're going to compare it. Shall we do a point system? So you got 20 and you got 25, so the 25 wins. But I can't do that point system. There's no such thing. Or will it be subjective? Meaning, I feel this is better than this. Or I feel this is equal to that. So the method of comparison is not told in the test. Number three, who will be the judge? If I bring a writing or if I myself write, who's going to judge this is better or worse or equal? Will it be a mullah in one of the masjids, mosques? Or will it be a neutral committee from the UN? Who will do the evaluation? By default, if you don't write it, it'll have to be me. Yes, it'll have to be you if you're doing this test. By default. And by default, if I'm the judge, then I have to be honest with myself. I have read other writings that are absolutely beautiful. Jalaluddin Rumi, Khalil Gibran, Omar Khayyam. You know, there was a Nobel laureate from my country. His name was Rabindranath Tagore. And he comes from the same state as me, Bengal. So he wrote in Bengali. Sometimes when I go back to Bengal and my relatives pull out some of Bengali writings and read Rabindranath Tagore's Bengali writings, the rhythm and movement is so beautiful. My jaw just drops open. It is so good. Honestly, I cannot say it's any worse than the Quran. I can't. Even Shakespeare. For that matter, even Isaiah. I love the prose of Isaiah. It's just beautiful writing. How can I say that's worse or better? If you ask me to be the judge, then the test is over. Honestly, I'm not trying to put it down. I'm just trying to be honest. Number four, I have in my library an English translation of the Quran by N.J. Dawood, because they said N.J. Dawood's translation is supposed to be the closest. So I picked that one up. But an Orthodox Muslim, if there's anybody of Muslim visiting here, you will confirm what I'm saying, that to an Orthodox Muslim, my English translation cannot be called the Quran. The Quran is the Quran only in the Arabic language. Only in that language is the Quran, because there's only one language of divine communication, it is Arabic. But many of my Muslim friends don't know one line of literary Arabic. I don't know. How many of here knows Arabic? Literary Arabic. None. Then none of you can do that test. So I can't do the test. So here's a test that is fuzzy and hazy, does not tell us how to check it out, does not tell who will check it out, and it has to be done only in a language that is applicable to a narrow segment of the world's population. It is not a genuine test. A test should be one that everybody can do and everybody can see that it came true. That's a test. So it is not a genuine test. Now we come to the Christian, Judeo-Christian, because I put those two together, because the nature of the test that is there. But before we go to it, I'd like to make a statement or read a statement from a brilliant scientist, Pierre Simon Laplace. Maybe you don't know, but I'm in medicine. We have Laplace's laws even today. He lived in the 17th and 18th century. But even today we have Laplace's laws. He was a brilliant French scientist. He lived about the same time as Sir Isaac Newton of UK, England. And he was known as the Sir Isaac Newton of France. He was so brilliant. Sir Isaac Newton was an avowed believer in God. Pierre Simon Laplace was exactly the opposite. A strident, ardent atheist. But this is what he stated, and it's called scientific determinism. Scientifically determined. And this is what he said. This is a long statement. I'm going to read it and I'm going to tell you what he really meant by it. We may regard the present state of the universe as the effect of its past and the cause of its future. And intellect, I don't know why he jumped to intellect. Because an atheist is not supposed to talk about any intellect beyond the human. But still he uses the word intellect very interestingly, and it intrigued me a lot. An intellect which at a certain moment would know all of the forces that set nature in motion and all positions of all items of which nature is composed, if this intellect were also vast enough to submit this data for analysis, it would embrace in a single formula the movements of the greatest bodies of the universe and those of the tiniest atom. For such an intellect, nothing would be uncertain, and the future, just like the past, would be present before its eyes. What he is saying is this. If there is an intellect, or a computer, but he used the word intellect, so I'm also going to use the word intellect. If there is an intellect that knows every particle in the universe, knows also every feature and property of every particle, also knows every law that governs all those particles, then that intellect, if he looks at anything today, he can interpolate backwards and go any period previous and say what happened 100 years, 500 years, and 1,000 years before. Because it's determined by the laws, all set. He could also do something else. He could also go forward in time. And 100 years, 500 years, he can say what will happen then too, because he knows everything of these particles. Every law he knows. It can come together and nothing would be uncertain to this intellect. The past would be present just like the future before its eyes. I don't know why he used the word eyes. Because he's an atheist. But he used the word intellect, also used the word eyes. Now, how do we test this out? You know, today they throw this statement out. Scientists don't like the statement because it is too wishful. Where is that intellect? This is talking fanciful talk. So they set it aside. Can't be determinism. The other reason they set it aside is because of quantum mechanics. But quantum mechanics has to do with only those particulate matter. When you come to solid matter, still the laws of physics do still apply. But how do you test this? Well, one way would be if this intellect came and sat in a chair like this and said, I'm the intellect. Yeah, but how will I test him? My intellect is only this big. So if he starts talking anything outside this big circle, then I will not be able to test him. Right? No, I can't test him. So how can I test him with something here that I can see? Well, there's a way. If this intellect keeps saying what will happen in the future, and it keeps happening, time 1, 2, 5, 10, 15, hey, then it could be the intellect. That's the exact test that is found in the Judeo-Christian scriptures as a test of the scriptures. Present your case, says the Lord. Let them bring forth and show us what will happen. Declare to us things to come. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that you are God, because only the God will know that intellect. Only that God will know every particle and every law that is in the universe. So that's the test. It's called predictive prophecy. Meaning, there's a prophecy here, and a fulfillment here. We can see when the prophecy was written. We can check out the fulfillment. And they are connected only because it was fulfilled. Not because this guy who predicted went and did it. Because if he did it, then the credibility goes down. It must be separate from the one who actually said it. It must be maybe in another country or another continent or another era or time. It's called predictive prophecy. I'm going to mention only one, and then we'll kind of conclude this morning's 8-hour seminar. Jeremiah wrote these words, that Babylon shall become a heap without an inhabitant, and also he said, I will make her springs dry, and he wrote this about 595, 596 BC. At that time, Babylon was the greatest, most fortified city in the world. Archaeologists have dug somewhere around there. It's still there. You can go and see some of the ruins. And they tell us what kind of a city it was. And I'm going to look at three factors. How wide those walls were. The top, two chariots could run side by side the entire perimeter. I mean, that means broad. The base, what do you think is the measurement from this wall to that wall? 45, 50? 4550. Do you know how broad the walls of Babylon were? The archaeologists have done that. I've seen these markers and they measured it 87 feet. Try breaking it down. How hard would you have to push? How high would the walls of Babylon go? That center place would be about 30, 35, 40 feet. The walls of Babylon would go up anywhere from 175 to 300 feet. So, if you're a general wanting to get that city, what do you do? You've got to have a ladder that big. But hey, wait a minute. You can't even get close to the wall because it is surrounded by a moat And they found that the moat is in volume the same as the wall. So 300 feet, where are you going to get any close to that city to overtake it? The only hope you have for a city like that is lay siege. What's laying siege? You put your soldiers at the gate and don't let anybody come in and out because your food is grown on the outside. Food has to be brought in. If it does not come in, you'll starve. So, all the gates, set your soldiers there, don't let anybody come in and out. But laying siege is not fighting. So you got to pay your soldiers just for standing there looking at the gate. So you got to be pretty wealthy as an emperor or as a king to lay siege to any city. Because you got to pay your soldiers for doing nothing. So you got to pay them month after month. So sieges would last months and maybe a year, 1.5 years, 2 years, maximum 3. Then your coffers are gone because you have not gone, you know, winning any victory. You have not gone to get their spoil to increase it in your coffers. So 3 years is maximum. Do you know why Babylon would laugh at anybody wanting to lay siege? Because in the storehouses of Babylon, there was food enough for every inhabitant of Babylon for a period of 20 years. Impregnable. You can't get anywhere near the wall. They are too big. They are too high. The moat is too broad. And you can't even lay siege. How do you win against a city? It says, I will make her springs dry. Do you know how Babylon fell? Cyrus, the Medo-Persian, came around and he was winning his battles until he came to Babylon and said, hey, Babylon is what I need to get. Then I'll be world emperor. But how to get it? So he's trying to figure out which way, how and where. And in his forays around Babylon, his horse, this is one story, his horse died in the river Euphrates. Now the river Euphrates was the water supply for Babylon. It went down one side and came out the other. Cyrus was mad with the river. Like many of these generals and kings of those ancient times, they went eccentric because of their power. He was so mad this river had killed his horse. So he called his general and said, I want this river dry. Wants to flow and kill my horse? Go dry. So his generals called his soldiers and said, hey, Cyrus wants it dry. Well, those guys got together and history says that they dug, those soldiers, 80 to 300 aqueducts or canals paralleling the river Euphrates and drained the river dry. As soon as it was drained dry, Cyrus saw his way into the city on the riverbed. You know how long it took to conquer Babylon? One night. There was not one drop of bloodshed. The soldiers just walked into the city on the riverbed, jumped out onto the streets because the gates were open because the guards were drunk that night. And when the people saw Cyrus's army, they had already seen the army from their walls, they gave in without a fight. And Babylon was conquered in one night. How? By making her springs dry. There was simply no other way. And today, few words evoke as many ancient images of ancient decadence and glory and prophetic doom, as does Babylon. Yet the actual place, 50 miles south of Baghdad, is flat, hot, deserted, dusty, deserted. Look, you don't have to get somebody else's word on this. You can go and read what Jeremiah wrote, and then catch a plane and go there to Baghdad. And you can see it with your own two eyes. It is still deserted. Did that come true? Predictive prophecy. How many prophecies like this would you require to become kind of convinced that we do have an idea who this intellect is? Pere Simon Laplace's intellect. How many? 4, 5, 10? Let me give you an example. Suppose I'm a prophet. And you're of Scandinavian descent. So everybody in your generations has long, blonde, straight hair. But I'm a prophet. So I come to you and say, you are going to have a son with curly black hair. Oh, wow. Not only that, at the age of 4, he will read all of Shakespeare's works. Oh, that's number 2. Number 3, at the age of 12, he will graduate from university with a professional degree. Number 4, at the age of 20, he will represent the United States at the Olympics and win the gold medal in the butterfly stroke, swimming. Specific. At the age of 30, he would have gone into astrophysics and he would have got a call from Europe saying, you've got the Nobel Prize. 5 predictions. Black, curly hair, reading all of Shakespeare's works, professional degree, winning the gold medal, winning the Nobel Prize. If all 5 came true, what would you think of me? Boy, you would chase me to the ends of the earth. Hey, tell me what's going to happen next to my son. So I'll know what's going to happen because I know what you're going to say is true. Right? Suppose I give you another 5 and they come true. Now what? Wow. Do you know how many prophecies there are in this Judeo-Christian scriptures? You know, I haven't counted everything. I've counted about 40 or 50. Look, 5 or 10 is enough for me. But I counted 40 or 50 scholars who have done, you know, kind of with a fine tooth comb, go through every little bit like they do. They tell us that there's about 322 about one single individual. 322. 24 to 25 of them came to pass in one weekend. Hey, not 5 over so many years. 25 in one weekend. If you're honest, searching like me, and if you had read Simon Pierre Laplace's scientific determination, which he said, the eyes of this person can see the past and the future just as if it is the present. Wow. I believe I have identified Pierre Simon Laplace's intellect. Look at these 2 sentences. One by a rank atheist whose name is Pierre Simon Laplace. Another by a believer who some people even call a prophet, in other words, a respected believer. Look at the sentences and see the similarity. For such an intellect, nothing would be uncertain and the future, just like the past, would be present before its eyes. And this person, E.G. White, the most prolific woman nonfiction writer in the United States, look at her statement. Some people call her a prophetess, yes. Look at her statement. Such an intellect, he. Makes good sense? An intellect can be called he? Yes. He that ruleth in the heavens is the one who sees the end from the beginning, the one before whom the mysteries of the past and the future are alike outspread. Look at the same word that he used. Future, future. Like, alike. Past, past. Eyes, sees. Saying the exact same thing. So when there's multiple sources saying the same thing, we better be impressed if we are honest. So here it is. From a brilliant atheistic scientist, from a respected believer in God, also known as a prophetess in some circles, this stuff is written in an ancient sacred literature which we can read today and check for ourselves whether it was written. It was written definitely before the event, and it is verifiable in secular history. What more does anyone want to know about the credibility of this book? So here we end today. The Judeo-Christian book. It is the best attested historical literature, least gaps in time. In fact, there's no gaps. the greatest manuscript evidence, and the authors were part of the story itself. So it's historical. And it also happens to be the only writing that permits an open test for possible divine origin. What do I say when I look at this spectrum? You know what I'd say? Give me the Bible. And all God's people said, amen. And not only did they say amen, they were going to sing it. So 272 is our closing song. Give me the Bible.